Before we start, a quick reminder. This podcast discusses sex, violence, and social oppression. It may be uncomfortable or triggering to some. If you're listening out loud, parts of this narrative may seem sensitive to those around you. In April 2010, Ramchandra Siras, the chair of modern Indian languages at Aligarh Muslim University, was found dead in his apartment. 2 days after he had last been seen, police broke into his home after neighbors alerted them about a smell. It was an alleged suicide, but some people suspect foul play. The case was never resolved. This was just days after the professor had won a case at the Allahabad High Court, regaining his job at the university after he had been fired.
Moving on, a professor of the Aligarh Muslim University on the verge of retirement has been fired for being gay. This new controversy has reignited the homosexuality debate on the university campus, and both students and teachers stand divided.
In early 2010, a few months after the Delhi High Court decriminalized homosexuality, two men barged into Siras's house and taped him having sex with another man.
The persons who enter in my house, they talk in very bad way and they threaten me while they make shooting.
Using the tapes as evidence, the university suspended him for gross misconduct. Anand Grover was Siras's lawyer. In the courtroom, he argued that consensual sex was no longer a crime in India, now that Section 377 had been read down by the Delhi High Court. Professor Siras won, and the court ordered the university to give him back his job. But just days after the ruling, he was found dead.
The professor's death is tragic.
The thing is, even though Siras won the case, he wasn't free from social stigma. Many of his colleagues at the university were convinced that he was in the wrong. They kept talking about moral values.
This is not a case of gay or... This is a purely case of moral.
Laws alone can't bring change without a change in mindsets.
From ATS Studio, I'm Sindhuri Nandakumar, and this is 377, a show about an archaic law, its fading impact, and the movement to get rid of it. In our previous episode, we talked about the hearings for the Nas Foundation case in the Delhi High Court. The two judges, Chief Justice A.P. Shah and Justice Muralidhar, used the concept of constitutional morality to read down Section 377.
There is a distinction between the popular morality and the constitutional morality.
The Constitution, they said, should determine whether a law should remain, not the views of the current majority.
It has to be constitutional morality, which is to be basis for the state's right to interfere with the person's fundamental right.
The Constitution was written decades after the Indian Penal Code came into effect, and the judges pointed out that this would obviously mean that some laws would be at odds with the values of India as a democracy. On the day the verdict was announced, there was a lot of activity on the High Court's grounds, a lot of media interviews. There was one television anchor for NDTV who asked a very pertinent question. She was speaking with Tripti Tandon from Lawyers Collective, who was fighting on behalf of Nas. The interviewer wanted to know, what next? Are you going to fight this case in other high courts? How are you going to spread awareness? And this is what Tripti Tandon had to say.
Well, the one thing is, what we will be watching out for now is whether the government will go in appeal. So I think the next few weeks will be crucial to see if there is any kind of decision on that side. Given the kind of hints that the government of India is giving, we hope that they will not go in appeal. But if they do, then it means another long-drawn legal battle, which we certainly do not want, but we will be up for if the need arises.
After the ruling, cases like Professor Siras's death served as reminders that there were sections of Indian society that didn't agree with the verdict. Today, we're going to talk about what happened next, because the story isn't over. Far from it. Just 5 days after the victory was announced, Suresh Kumar Kaushal, an astrologer based in Delhi, filed a special leave petition in the Supreme Court, challenging the Nas Foundation judgment. A special leave petition is a legal tool that allows you to challenge a court's decision based on your conviction that it's wrong or unconstitutional. Suresh Kumar Kaushal wasn't the only one to file an SLP. That year, 15 other parties did the same. B.P. Singhal from the 2009 case, Baba Ramdev, the Tamil Nadu Muslim Munnetra Kalagam, Utkal Christian Council, Joint Action Council Kannur, All India Muslim Personal Law Board, the Delhi Commission for Protection of Child Rights. It was a diverse group of people. In many of the television debates at the time, you would see a Hindu Swami, a Muslim cleric, and a Christian priest sitting together, arguing on the same side.
My God, we did the impossible. We got the Hindu, Muslim, Christian groups to come together.
So in 2012, this unlikely coalition made it to the Supreme Court and argued that decriminalization had been a mistake. They wanted 377 reinstated in its full form.
मेरी प्रतिक्रिया जो है बिल्कुल स्वाभाविक है मेरे को ना भाई बहुत कोई खुशी है ना कोई गर्व का एहसास हो रहा है
Mr. Kaushal, the astrologer and lead petitioner, had noticed an uptick in the number of same-sex couples who started showing up at temples hoping to get married. He didn't think India was ready for this sort of progress.
क्योंकि हम लोग जो हैं इस प्रकार के कल्चर के लिए इस प्रकार के लाइफ ओरिएंटेशन के लिए तैयार नहीं है
But here's the thing. Kaushal had nothing to do with the 2009 case.
So these were uninterested parties in that they have not been affected by the law themselves in any sense. They want to support the law, but not for any personal interest involved in the case.
That's Tarunab Khaitan.
I'm Tarunab Khaitan. I'm the professor of law at universities of Oxford and Melbourne.
I relied a lot on Tarunab to understand the Kaushal case. We talked about the makeup of the Indian Supreme Court and how the country's legal system is set up so that anyone can, in theory, have access to the highest court in the country. It meant someone like Kaushal could escalate matters to the apex court, even though he wasn't directly involved in 2009. The original petitioner, the NAS Foundation, had to return to court to defend the 2009 ruling. And because the case had to do with the constitution and an interpretation of a law, the government also had to participate.
And, you know, usually when a law is declared unconstitutional, the main interested party is the state, the government and its parliament, which, if they want the law to be upheld, seek to do so.
In this case, after 2009, the government hadn't appealed the verdict. They had accepted it. But Suresh Kumar Kaushal couldn't accept it. I read an interesting analogy about this. Vikram Raghavan, a law scholar, wrote about how unusual the whole thing was. He used India's favorite sport, cricket, to make his point. He said it's like after the match, the two opposing sides have accepted the outcome and gone home. But then a spectator calls them back, says he didn't like the outcome and asks for a rematch. And this time, he wants to be captain of one team. And he did it. Suresh Kumar Kaushal, an astrologer, won his case. On December 12, 2013, or 11-12-13 as the date is referred to by some, two judges in the Supreme Court reversed the 2009 ruling of the Delhi High Court. Homosexuality was criminal once again.
Supreme Court ne corrective surgery ki hai. Supreme
surgery ki hai.
Haan, Supreme.
Achha.
To understand how this came about, we have to take a look at what happened inside the courtroom in 2012. That's when the matter of Suresh Kumar Kaushal and others versus NAS Foundation was argued in the Supreme Court in front of two judges, Justice G.S. Singhvi and Justice S.J. Mukhopadhyay. The courtroom atmosphere was very different to the proceedings of the Delhi High Court in 2008. Vivek Diwan, a queer lawyer who had worked with the Lawyers Collective and was now living abroad, happened to be in India during this time. His brother Shyam was a lawyer arguing on behalf of one of the parties, a collective called Voices Against 377.
I remember Shyam telling me that it's trouble. It's looking like real trouble.
So Vivek went to find out for himself.
So I said, we can't possibly. But then I went to court and it was shocking to see the utter discomfort of the judges and even talking about sexuality. Just, the, you know, it was like the school kids kind of squirming on their seats while this topic was, while sexuality and queerness was being discussed.
The focus of this trial was also different. Back in 2009, the judges had been interested in whether Section 377 was constitutional. They pointed out that this law had been written in the 19th century, but the Constitution of India was created in the 20th century. The judges wanted to know, is 377 compliant with the guarantees of the Constitution? Does it uphold the same values and provide the fundamental rights that are promised to citizens?
I can give you some examples like the untouchability. So this was approved by majority, but the constitution has prohibited untouchability. The untouchability was abolished. There is a distinction between the popular morality and the constitutional morality.
They didn't care too much about the meaning of words like carnal and against the order of nature. But in 2012, there was a lot more focus on the meanings of words. The judges really got hung up on this. Sometimes it feels like they went about in circles trying to figure out what these words meant. At one point, Justice Mukhopadhyay asked a lawyer, if a gynecologist inserts a hand inside to find out if a baby is all right, is it against the order of nature? So, in 2009, the question was, does this law, which criminalizes gay sex, violate the Constitution of India? But in 2012, it was simply, does this law say that gay sex is a crime? Over the course of many days, the pro-377 lawyers argued that the reading down of the law had been erroneous and that the Delhi High Court had been wrong. In true representation of their diversity, they had a mix of views. They talked about the sins of homosexuality, about Indian values, conspiracy theories, about the very meaning of nature. One lawyer even said, the sun always rises in the east. Gay sex is always a crime. The list goes on. The main thrust of the arguments, though, was that the Delhi High Court's application of Articles 14, 15, and 21 of the Constitution had been incorrect. Okay, so we need to jump into a little bit of legalese here. Article 14. The state shall not deny to any person equality before the law or the equal protection of the laws. Article 14 is what promises us equality. If you want to argue that a law violates Article 14, you have to be able to prove one class of people is treated differently than most, that it picks them out and makes life difficult for them. That raises a question. Are sexual minorities a class of their own? Now, to be clear, Section 377 doesn't mention the words gay or homosexual anywhere. In the 2009 verdict, the judges pointed this out. They said that the law was facially neutral. It didn't call out any person. What it criminalized was an act, the act of carnal intercourse against the order of nature. But, the judges said, because these criminalized acts are associated with homosexuals, they could be considered a class of people. And therefore, the law violated Article 14. In 2012, the pro-caution team had a big problem with this application of Article 14. One lawyer argued that if you see LGBTQ people as a class, then it only paves the way for other groups of people to be given freedoms that they don't deserve. He said that using this rationale, any group of people associated with an act could be a protected class. Murderers and dowry seekers could say that they've been discriminated against. Again and again, this camp kept saying, the law doesn't criminalize homosexuals, we don't have a problem with them. But the act of unnatural sex, which gay sex happens to be, is not okay. So when the judgment was delivered in 2013, the judges said this. It is relevant to mention here that the Section 377 IPC does not criminalize a particular people or identity or orientation. It merely identifies certain acts which, if committed, would constitute an offense. Article 15. The state shall not discriminate against any citizen on grounds of religion, race, caste, sex, or place of birth. In 2009, the judges said that Section 377 violated Article 15 of the Constitution. They made this argument by zeroing in on the word sex. And they said sex is not just gender, but it also includes sexual orientation. This is a really interesting debate, and it's happening across the world. In June 2020, the Supreme Court of the US had to make a similar decision. Does that country's Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex, also include sexual orientation and gender identity? Here's one of the lawyers arguing in court, stating that yes, sexual orientation comes under the umbrella of sex.
We'll hear argument first this morning in case 17-16-18, Bostick versus Clayton County, and the consolidated case. Ms. Carlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. When an employer fires a male employee for dating men but does not fire female employees who date men, he violates Title VII. The employer has, in the words of Section 703A, discriminated against the man because he treats that man worse than women who want to do the same thing. And that discrimination is because of sex, again in the words of Section 703A, because the adverse employment action is based on the male employee's failure to conform to a particular expectation about how men should behave, namely that men should be attracted only to women and not to men.
A landmark ruling out of the Supreme Court this morning. We have been awaiting this decision, and the decision now is clear from the Supreme Court. They have issued a ruling that now bans discrimination by employers against transgender individuals and gay individuals.
Back to India. In 2009, the judges of the Delhi High Court used similar reasoning to arrive at a similar conclusion. Here's Chief Justice Shah talking about that in an earlier interview, where he said that this was the strongest argument in the case.
I would say that the most compelling ground, looking back, I would say that the Article 15.2, that is non-discrimination, was the most compelling ground. Article 15 prohibits discrimination on the ground of race, caste, sex, place of birth, etc. The question was whether sex, term sex, would include sexuality.
In 2009, the judges said, yes, it did. But in the 2013 verdict, the Supreme Court kept saying that because 377 didn't explicitly discriminate against a named group of people or a class, it could not be read that way. The law was just. Article 21. No person shall be deprived of his life or personal liberty except according to procedure established by law. You've probably sensed a pattern by now. In 2009, the Delhi High Court said the law violated Article 21 and that the idea of popular morality, what people think should be allowed, isn't enough to restrict the fundamental rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution. In 2013, the court disagreed, choosing instead to point out that the Delhi High Court's verdict had relied too much on foreign case law and international examples. And so, nearly 18 months after the case was heard in 2012, Justice Singhvi read from the verdict on his last day as a Supreme Court judge. And it went like this. In view of the above discussion, we hold that Section 377 IPC does not suffer from the vice of unconstitutionality, and the declaration made by the division bench of the High Court is legally unsustainable. As a kind of postscript of sorts, the judgment also said, we think this is a matter for Parliament. If the legislature wants to scrap 377, be our guest. But this court isn't going to do it. Classic government office. Not this line, go stand in that line. But they didn't stop there. The judges said the country's queer population was a minuscule fraction. I was a bit stunned by that. Now, I don't know too much about the law, but I'm fairly certain that the role of a court is to uphold rights for everyone. One of the lawyers who argued in the case, the late Ashok Desai, said that it was strange for a court to say that a particular number of people was too small to protect, given that courts are an important way in which minority groups defend their rights. The legal principle that the court had applied here is called de minimis.
De minimis? Is that how you pronounce it?
I asked lawyer Tarunab Khetan to explain how it worked.
So the de minimis principle is often used in multiple legal contexts for a variety of reasons. The de minimis principle is basically a threshold setting idea. It's the idea that the court will not deal with frivolities.
Sounds fair.
So let's say that somebody brings a case of assault against you because you chucked a paper ball at them. Now, technically, that qualifies as assault in law. But the damage or the harm that you suffered is so small that at the remedy stage, in deciding how much to compensate you for, the court may apply the de minimis principle. It might grant you minimal damages or nothing at all, right? Even though you win the case.
But is that really what happened in Kaushal?
In the Kaushal judgment, the two judges of the Supreme Court apply the de minimis principle wrongly to a fundamental rights matter. Now, that is highly unusual. And in fact, I cannot think of any case in India or abroad where a court has applied the de minimis principle. And also the de minimis principle in a strange way, because the court does not say that the harm that the complainants had suffered in the case did not meet any threshold. The court instead used the de minimis principle to say that the number of people affected by the law in question is so small. And by the way, this small is relative, right? Even a small percentage, 5% of India's population in absolute numbers, is massive.
The de minimis principle, the idea of being labeled a minuscule minority, really upset people in the LGBTQI community. They had essentially been told that they didn't matter. There was one moment in court during the hearings that drove home the point that the judges weren't really sensitized to the plight of queer people. Maybe because they didn't know any. Imagine yourself inside the courtroom. Mr. P.P. Malhotra, ASG, is representing the Home Ministry. Here he is in an earlier interview expressing his views better than I can sum them up for you.
No, the judgment of the High Court was totally wrong, I would say. It is against morality. We are living in a country in India where morality is the first thing. And it is totally against morality to allow such things. That should be the clear stand of every Indian, because this is totally against morality. I mean, nobody can think of this, such kind of things. This homosexuality is a sickness. You have to cure this, not encourage it.
How do you cure this?
This is to teach them moral values, to teach them how you cure
people. Mr. Malhotra, I just want to ask you, in 2009, in the Delhi High Court, when you argued it and when you placed this forward, it was met with a lot of vehemence by the Chief Justice at that time, Justice A.P. Shah, and that judgment that he came out with was celebrated by everyone. Despite that...
No, it is wrong. It is a few people who celebrated that judgment. It's a group of 30 or 50 people who are all the time on the road with the flags and everything.
Okay, my last question to you.
In 2012, he's inside the courtroom, reading from his arguments about why homosexuality should be outlawed. Justice Singhvi interrupts him and says, Mr. Malhotra, by the way, nothing to do with the case, but do you know any person who is homosexual? Mr. Malhotra says he doesn't, and Justice Singhvi says he doesn't either. Later on, Shyam Diwan presents his arguments on behalf of Voices Against 377. He reads from the affidavits that tell the stories of people who have suffered because of this law, both directly and indirectly. And Justice Singhvi asks Shyam, how many homosexuals do you think there are? It really felt like he was looking for a crash course on Indian homosexuality, rather than trying to understand the constitutionality of the law. Shyam responds by saying that he doesn't want to take a guess. And he goes on to say, more than numbers, since you asked Mr. Malhotra the other day if he knew homosexuals, I would like to answer it. Gay people are my colleagues. They're in my inner circle. They're in my family. They are my friends. They are normal citizens deserving of full dignity. Vivek Diwan was in the courtroom when this question was asked.
And I was actually about to, like, Arvind was sitting in front of me, I was going to tug his gown and say, let's just stand up. Let's stand up now.
That's Arvind Narayan, lawyer for Voices Against 377.
And we stand up, and then we point to everyone else in the courtroom, and everyone will stand up, and there'll be 40 of us, some of us lawyers, many of us queer activists in the back behind in the gallery. And he realized.
But even as he was thinking that, Vivek knew that this wouldn't fly.
But also, this is not a Bollywood film set. I cannot possibly stand up. It's a joke if I stand up. I mean, then we'll start dancing next, you know? That's just not happening. Because this is the solemn kind of portals of the Supreme Court, yeah? You can't just stand up. It's all that drama won't do.
But things didn't improve. Here's Zanish Sheikh, a legal scholar and queer activist who was in the courtroom.
So I think The constant feeling that one had in the courtroom in that period, and this was over 6 weeks, was the sense of like a weight that was falling on a lot of us. The sense of restaging a lot of the hurt and the shame that had happened outside the courtroom space, but now it was happening inside the courtroom. It was these two senior members of the judiciary who were just saying these things.
But even though the judgment upheld 377, it never did explain what exactly counted as a crime under the law. Constitutional experts like Tarunab Khaitan found many flaws with the verdict. The most important one was also a very basic flaw. Here's Arvind Narayan talking to the press the day after the verdict.
The point I really want to make is this. It's the role and responsibility of the Supreme Court to ensure that the rights of all citizens are guaranteed and respected. The court is to play the role of a counter-majoritarian institution. And it's very clear that regardless of what majorities think, the court has to protect the rights of the minority. And it's this responsibility which the court has failed in, and it's this responsibility which the court fails in today, it will fail with respect to other minorities tomorrow. So our point is, the Supreme Court has to self-correct itself.
The Supreme Court isn't just a court of appeals. It's also a constitutional court and is supposed to interpret the Constitution of India and reveal new dimensions and angles to it. It's supposed to interpret the freedoms granted to citizens. But in this case, again and again, the judges wanted to know what the law meant, rather than focusing on whether it was constitutional. When gay rights activists condemned the ruling, Judge Singhvi didn't seem to think anything was wrong with it. On the day of the verdict, one television anchor asked him this.
So many are saying, has the Supreme Court lost a historic opportunity here, sir?
He places his hand on the microphone of the anchor and says,
please read the judgment. My request would be, all comments are being made without anybody reading the judgment. It will be better to read the judgment.
But sir, you've left it in the domain of parliament and the government. Could the court have taken a more proactive stand, like you've done in many other cases, like in the 2G case?
Then Justice Singhvi places a hand on the television anchor's head and says,
I request you, young sister, first read the judgment.
But that is what we've done, as have countless other people. In fact, other judges in the Supreme Court will address the Kaushal judgment in their own verdicts and even admit that it had ruled incorrectly. That's on our next episode. Thanks to the Orinam website for the courtroom scenes and commentary that we used to report this episode. 377 is a production of ATS Studio, a division of All Things Small. This episode was hosted by me, Sindhuri Nandakumar, and written by me and Ashim De Silva, who also produced the show. Script supervision is by Deveya Bopanna and Archana Nathan, with editorial input from Sidin Varukut and Supriya Nair. The music and sound design is by Madhav Ayachit, and the episode is mixed and mastered by Ankit Suryakant. Our executive producer is Gaurav Vaz. Our legal consultant is Amshula Prakash. We received administrative support from Anushka Mukherjee. All clips and voices used in this podcast are owned by their original creators. You can find more information about this episode and our show notes at allthingssmall.in/377.